Hi, this is Ted Ballacher with Reason TV. Today I'm at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles, California, and I'll be sitting down with political satirist and author P.J. O'Rourke.
His latest book is Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending. Stick around and hear O'Rourke's take on bailouts, easy women, and who ruined the U.S. auto industry.
The automobile, although it's seen as, you know, the source of all this bad stuff, it does produce a lot of wealth for a lot of people.
The automobile is the source of no bad stuff in America. There wouldn't be an America without an automobile. We are a huge country. And we, you know, this country just didn't come together as a nation until the car was invented because of basically transport problems. We would be a kind of, we'd be Australia if it weren't for the car, you know. No offense to Australia, it's a nice enough country, but it's too few people in too huge a space. It just never came together as a real nation.
You talk a lot about the American love affair with the automobile. Do you think that's been replaced with a love affair with trains in the form of rail transit, light rail?
Yes, there's something romantic about the train, but try getting the tracks to come to your house. I mean, when it comes time to unload the groceries, the romance with the train disappears immediately.
Well, maybe it's more than the politicians' love affair with the
trains. Why do politicians love trains? Because they can tell where the tracks go. They know where everybody's going. I mean, politicians, it's all about control. It is all about power. Politics itself is nothing but an attempt to achieve power and prestige without merit. That is the definition of politics. Politicians hate cars. They've always hated cars because cars make people free. Not only free in the sense that they can go anywhere they want, which is bugs politicians in the first place, but they can move out of the political district that the politician represents.
So if it is mostly the politicians who are in love with the trains, in that vein, I want to show you a little something from a book called Transport of Delight by Jonathan Richman. This goes back to 1991 when here in Los Angeles they opened up their very first rail transit line, the Blue Line, and they decided to open it on Valentine's Day because, of course, you know, again,
America,
a love affair.
Loves trains.
And I just want you to take a look at how it was announced.
A tunnel just waiting for a train, a heart-shaped tunnel, a tunnel just calling Dr. Freud.
Does it bother you when you hear new urbanists and others talk? It's a favorite refrain of journalists that we're addicted to our automobiles.
It doesn't bother me. I want to strangle them. It's a little bit beyond bother, you know. I want to stuff them in their Prius and lock the doors is what I want to do, you know. They just don't know what they're talking about. Americans were able to create the life that we have in America by being able to get out of the big cities. It was the corruption of the urban political machines, lousy public schools, insane municipal bureaucracies. The reason we live in the suburbs is because we were able to escape those things. And the reason we were able to escape those things, it wasn't the train. It was the car that allowed us to get far enough away from that stuff to build a decent life.
And now with fast forward to GM and so many people calling it government motors these days and the typical scattershot way of government, we're hearing about all their new goals, cleaner, greener. Somewhere on the list is making cars that people want to buy.
Somewhere way down on the list, because if you want to see a government-owned automobile, go get an East German Trabant. That's the kind of cars the government makes. You know, it's going to be garbage. And, of course, it's garbage from a number of points of view. The success of capitalism has everything to do with failure. I mean, people talk about the wealth that capitalism creates, but the poverty that capitalism creates in capitalists, not in poor people, is also extremely important. When a business fails, it's time for there's a reason for the business failing. They're making a product nobody wants to buy. You don't come in there and save that product. The Obama administration has got this economic thing, which is if it's working, tax the hell out of it. If it's not working, bail it out. And if it's just scraping by, drop Barney Frank on it till it screams for help. This is an insane approach.
So there's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about what went wrong with the U.S. auto industry. What, in your estimation, went wrong?
Well, I think several things happened. One was government regulation. The government regulation, particularly in the post-1973, after the first Arab oil embargo, the imposition on automobiles of CAFE standards, of fuel standards, of emission standards, of endless safety standards. All these things were very bad for the car. They made the car more complex, less elegant, uglier in the case of 5-mile-an-hour bumpers. They worked on spoiling the American love affair with the car. There's also a lot of mandated technology involved here. The government wasn't satisfied in saying, look, you know, the cars are making the air dirty. Can you guys make the cars cleaner? They wanted to tell them how to make the cars cleaner. Well, these people don't know it, but the politicians don't know anything about engineering. So the situation was very much like, okay, Dad burns dinner. So we get the dog to cook. You know, we find the one person who knows, you know, the creature who knows even less about the subject, and we put him in charge. So there was that problem. And also there was the problem of volatility. It takes a long time to design and produce an automobile, 4 years, 5 years, to get an automobile through from its conception stage to it actually rolling off the production line. Cars companies have always faced the problem of volatility of consumer demand. After all, the great bulk of American automobile companies have failed and not been bailed out. Where was the government?
And we're still here.
We're still here.
People
yeah.
still had jobs. Where How
was
did that
the,
happen?
Yeah, where was the government with Studebaker? Where was the government with Packard? Where were they with Hudson? Where were they with Nash? You know, where were they with Crosley's? You know, never mind. But anyway, a lot of car companies have failed over the years due to one type of volatility of consumer demand. Very scary. But if you add to that volatility in commodity prices, see, car companies, for most of the 100 years that cars have been around, have been able to predict with reasonable accuracy, exception for World War II maybe, what gasoline was going to cost and what the iron and steel and stuff that goes into an automobile. Starting with the 70s, you get into a period of volatility where car companies are forced to design cars that are going to come out in 5 years. Not only don't they know what the public's going to want in 5 years, but they also don't know what the stuff that the car is made out of is going to cost. If you add on to that the third kind of volatility, the real crime of government intervention in automobiles is not any specific thing that they ask for. Cleaner air is good. Using less gas, that's probably good. Even 5-mile-an-hour bumpers and safety standards, all this is good. But you couldn't tell what the government was going to ask for next. So you get regulatory volatility. So all of a sudden, car companies are facing three kinds of volatility instead of just one kind of volatility.
From Chevy to Ford, you see a lot of conflating the purchase of an American car with patriotism. Do you think it's patriotic to buy an American car?
Of course not. In first place, most American cars aren't actually American cars. I mean, the parts come from all over the place. The car itself may have been assembled in Canada or Mexico. There's no such thing as an American car. All cars are international cars now. On the other hand, the Toyota you buy may be made in the United States. The Honda you buy definitely will be made in the United States. The BMW you buy will be made in the United States. The Volkswagens, too. So you don't know whether you're buying an American car. Now, just buy a good car. Buy the car that you want.
Can you talk a bit about your ideological journey? You started off with very different political beliefs than you have now.
I started out on the left because I was a kid, and it was the 60s, and the girls on the left would do it. It was that simple, really. It's okay. I remember my freshman year.
That's the key to outreach. I mean, the Republicans are looking for
what Republicans have to do is have more sex, and then, you know, a Palin is like a step in the right direction. Obviously, the Palin family has a fair amount of sex, and not quite as much as David Letterman thinks they do, but, you know, nonetheless. I was walking down an alley. First weekend at college, my freshman year, I'm walking down an alley, and there's a bar. Bars on two sides of this alley. One bar is filled with all the sort of like sorority and fraternity jock types. Good-looking kids, beautiful girls, and all dressed up very nicely and having fun and looking quite attractive. But I'm thinking, I'm not good-looking, and I'm not an athlete, and I can't even afford a fraternity. I'm not getting in there. And then on the other side of the alley, there was this bar called Mac and Joe's. And out over there are equally attractive girls, these girls who iron their hair, and they're playing Kumbaya on the guitar, and they're smoking Lucky Strikes and drinking beer out of the bottle. And I'm thinking, well, those girls are very cute, too, and I'll bet they do it. You know, I persisted in my Marxism till I was 22 or 23, and I got a job. I'm a leftist. I'm a socialist. I'm for sharing everything. I get a job as a messenger in New York, $150 a week, get paid every 2 weeks. I'm really looking forward to that $300. Really looking forward to it. And so is my landlord. I mean, this is more money than I've had in my hands in a long time. I get my paycheck. I net out at like $185.93 after federal tax and state tax and city tax and Social Security contribution and retirement fund, which I was very interested in that age, and the health care benefits and all this stuff and union dues. I net out at $180-something. And I go, wait a minute. I've been a socialist all these years. I've been screaming for socialism, yelling for socialism, demonstrating for socialism. And I discovered we have socialism. They just took half my pay. I'm not Rockefeller. Well, they're taking half my pay, you know. That was the end of that.
That's what it takes, kids. The journey from easy sex to paycheck.
Easy sex to paychecks.
When you were in the early years of your career, you were sort of in the midst of a rightward turn in the nation.
Yeah.
Do you think that's over now?
Yes. The public tends to vibrate between, the public loves freedom and it loves getting things for free. You know, you can't, I mean, you know, this is only human. And so politically, the public has a tendency to vibrate between the benefits of freedom, that would be Reagan, and getting things for free, that would be Obama. And so they go back and forth. And after they get things for free for a while, they realize there actually is a price attached to the stuff they're getting for free. And the price can be quite high. The price can be like living in the Carter administration. So they go, okay, all right. You know, we realize there's no free lunch. And so we go for freedom itself. And they go through, and then they find out that freedom itself has a certain price called responsibility. You're supposed to take care of yourself. You're supposed to solve your own problems. Well, everybody hates solving their own problems. And along comes somebody and says, hey, I have free problem solving over here, you know? And they go back to, after all, you know, if human beings had a capacity to learn these lessons easily, a Ponzi scheme would have only worked once with Mr. Ponzi, right? But here's Mr. Madoff. You know? It works over and over again.
And Social Security.
The largest Ponzi scheme ever, yeah.
You're one of the most quotable guys around, and one quote that I attribute to you or have for a long time is something to the effect of the job of a president is to stand around for 4 years and take credit for anything good that happens. Is that really, I mean, is this whole
job... I don't know
job
if I said for sure if I said that, but I'm saying it now.
Okay, all right. Is it, even Republicans do it, Democrats do it, of course Obama's doing it.
This job creation hocus pocus, is it really just back to the time when we were primitive tribesmen and we killed the king if we had a bad crop yield and we praised the king if we had a great harvest?
It isn't back to that time. It's always been that time. I mean, we look to political leadership for all sorts of things that political leadership can't possibly deliver. And we just bless them, you know. I mean, when we had a walkover in the Gulf War in 1991, we just couldn't have been happier with George Bush, with Senior George Bush. He had 110% approval ratings, you know. Like a month later, we go into recession and we're ready to slaughter the guy. I mean, we throw him overboard in favor of this bozo from Arkansas with the world's most unpleasant marriage and roving hands besides, you know. And it's, oh God, you go, and you start to realize that the real job of a conservative, the real job of a libertarian, the real job of people who are in favor of individual freedom and individual responsibility is not to back one side or back the other side. It's to convince people to back away from politics. Government and politics is there for very, very limited purposes. There are just a few things that we need from the political system. We do need rule of law. We do need protection from external enemies. We need protection from each other when we misbehave, which is the rule of law part. And, you know, to some extent, because this is always true with governments, even no matter how pure a libertarian one is, you have to realize that the government does provide help to people in catastrophic circumstances. Something like Katrina, your city floods, government is supposed to come help you bail. You know, I mean, there's no doubt about that. But that's it for government. They help us in utter catastrophes when we're completely incapable of helping ourselves. They defend us from external enemies, and they defend us from internal enemies. They've got a legal monopoly on deadly force, and that's it. And when we start to ask them for, also, would you make sure that our food has no trans fats, and my shoes don't fit, and could you get me a better haircut? You know, you know, a couple of things. First place, they'll say yes because they love power. They're bad people. People who go into politics are bad people. Let's just face it. Secondly, they're not going to do a good job at this stuff because you can't task an organization with that many duties and expect them to do all of them or even any of them well. So it's self-defeating on a couple of different levels. People will use your requests to grab power from you, and they will also do a damn bad job with the power that they've grabbed.